Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The following conversation was recorded before a live audience as part of my Film Independent and LACMA screening series. There I spoke to J.C. Chandor and Oscar Isaac about their new film, A Most Violent Year. Here's the conversation.
So, you do more running in this movie. What kind of shape were you in before you started shooting, for God's sake?
Not very good shape, not at all. That's why I had that face plant in the middle of the whole thing.
Yeah, it said that in the script, that you were out of shape.
Yeah.
I mean, because I didn't know what was worse, watching you run into the snow after the assailant with no shoes on, or taking that fall during the run. I mean, that was pretty painful to watch.
It was painful to experience, too.
I want to ask you about your first conversation, Uncle JC, because his movies have all been about pride. I mean, these guys who are like too proud for their own good. And I want your first conversation was about the character with him.
I think our the very first conversation we really had about it is when you took me out in Williamsburg and drove me over to these tankers that were right on the water.
Where we ended up shooting the final scene.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the second to last scene.
And so the first conversations were actually less about what was happening emotionally and more about the landscape and showing me what the vision is, literally the vision. You know, it's like, these are the tankers, this is what he's trying to buy. You can see that there's a view of Manhattan. And then from there, explaining the world of it. And he kind of kept the actual emotional aspect of it quite mysterious. And even when I started reading the script for the first time, it didn't reveal its secrets to me right away. In fact, it was very hard to penetrate. I think also for me, I'm so bored by business and money and heating
Oscar's
oil.
Like, I don't like money, I don't like real estate, and I don't like business, but I want to play this part. And I was like, good pitch there.
So it was about trying to find the emotion in it and what that was about. And, you know, so I would ask JC these questions and he'd be like, the suits are going to be amazing.
Well, they are right down, even wearing a double-breasted coat. I mean, you probably have double-breasted pajamas in the movie, for God's sake.
No, it's true. But then he did say, you know, but the suits are not about fashion. They're his armor.
No, they're power suits.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all about the strategy. It's all about the presentation. And once I started infiltrating that and really understanding that the heating oil and all those things, that was just that's the commodity. You know, he's really about someone with vision and optimism. And when everyone else is fleeing the city, he's choosing to build and to try to grow into that in that world.
Well, JC, I want to ask you about this pride thing, because all is lost, and in Margin Call in this movie too, the idea of pride being an incredibly dangerous thing is key to the way you build your protagonists.
Yeah, I think, it's always pride with a combination of something else. So, you know, which pride is essentially a form of ego, I guess. So it's, you know, the sort of sacrificial lamb of the movie, the Julian character, is essentially done in by ego. You know, it's combined with panic, which ego and panic are a terrible, terrible combination. And so, as Chris runs by him, the actor who kind of plays the bad guy, who's Oscar's chasing the whole movie essentially, ran by and he asked me what I wanted him to say to him. And I sort of said, embarrass him, you know, poke him with a stick essentially. And so as Chris runs by him, he says, you better run cuz, you know, C-U-Z, in this sort of almost challenging way. And then he hears those sirens and he runs. So that's literally his downfall. At that moment, if he had stayed there and just turned himself in, it's 1981 in New York, no one was shot or anything, so a gun goes off, he probably would have been out by 5 or 6 o'clock that afternoon, frankly.
You clearly are a white person talking about
exactly.
This.
Yeah, exactly. Touché. Now, Abel's got some connections, you know, and Albert would have gotten in there and got him out. But the sad part of that scene, of course, is he chooses to run, and at that point, one terrible mistake, in this country, in any country, you know, can be something you recover from moments later. And nothing is ever thought of it again, or it can be something that changes your entire life, obviously. And in this case, he then becomes a pawn in something else that's much larger than him. And so that final scene when Oscar is running, that's all about ego and pride, essentially. That's revenge. It's you know, that the way it kind of calls him down into that tunnel is all ego. There's really nothing that could come from that, for the most part, that isn't. And so it's only in letting go of that that he actually gets something out of it.
But of course, Oscar.
No, but what you're going to say about pride as well. I mean, he does say it at one point. Have some pride in what you do. Yeah. And I think you're right. It is a battle with pride. Interestingly enough, with his wife, I think he swallows his pride a lot, and that's part of the reason why that relationship works. You know, he allows. She demands to be the most powerful person in the room often, and as opposed to the kind of hot-headed Latin cliche, he cedes that power. You know, it's like, all right, yes, you need to have my balls in a vice now. That's fine. You can do that. You can, if that's what you need. And she says at one point, you've always been so good at not letting ego get in the way. You know, don't stop now because of me, because it's me. And I think you're right. I think the interesting thing is trying to maintain that sense of pride when everyone around you is calling you a pussy, basically, and saying, you know, you're not protecting your family, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, but having that kind of singularity of vision to believe that your strategy ultimately will be the right one.
No, because when we first met JC, we talked about masculine archetypes in movies, and you give him that in this. I mean, he's so controlled, and the only time he sort of releases a little bit when he's running by himself, even when he's sitting in a room by himself working, he's completely in control.
Yeah. No, I mean, he is, you know, obviously what I'm playing with, the overarching, the sort of structure is kind of this classic, going back to the 1930s, almost gangster film. You know, it just follows all.
You haven't dressed like he's in a gangster film.
Yeah, the signposts going by are all these very familiar sort of things. But, you know, the opening shot of Jessica is like right out of any femme fatale role that's ever been played. She's literally in front of a mirror in a lingerie, in a nightgown, combing her hair, looking at herself, and her last real sort of meaningful action in the movie is the absolute opposite of that, obviously, which is he has to go outside for her signature to actually purchase this thing, and then it's at that moment you realize, you know, she's probably had more to do with the day-to-day success of the company than he has, frankly. You know, she's sort of kept it in business. So at that point, you sort of realize, hopefully, that even though the entire film, like her role as a, you know, this, my wife's a painter, and she gets to go out with like a couple $100 of paint and sort of have this experience alone. For us to do what we got to do, we got to have like 500 people and a couple $1 million. You want to go out there and sort of and make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. And in a way, I'm playing off that entire history of those films, but trying to do something a little different with it, obviously, and flip it on its tail, where the woman in the end, even though she's following basically the exact same amount of screen time that she would in a classic gangster film. You know, the scenes are almost exactly the same they would be. It's a totally different experience by the end, hopefully.
Because I was wondering, Oscar, too, if you maybe studied Edward G. Robinson a little bit, because I just noticed that. I mean, he walks into a room chest first. I mean, he's this sort of physical embodiment of pride, and that's why I thought maybe you guys would discuss that as being kind of a building block of the character.
No, I didn't. I mean, obviously, that I've seen his movies, and I've a lot of these gangster films as well. They're kind of in my DNA from watching them so much. But it really came from the note of his suits are armor, and so embodying that. You know, the idea that he's at war, that everything is about presentation. You know, he squares off at all times against people. The way he sits, I mean, really, that coat creates a cement block, you know? And that really is what informed that.
I was even noticing too, JC, that one of the things you're really interested in is putting people in big rooms, but bringing them very close together.
Yeah.
And that does something. Yeah, that often intimidates a person who's being moved in on.
Yeah, I mean, this is a character, I spoke about it with Bradford, the DP.
Bradford Young,
on this,
the terrific DP on this one.
Brad Young, who's done an amazing, amazing work, and we both kind of grew as filmmakers through this process. But one of our first meetings, I said, this is a guy who, when he walks into a room, it's as if he's walking into a sort of painting that he's already composed, right? So, you know, and he's not going to get, you know, that same philosophy of keep staring at the person until you close. He's not going to stand up when he has established his position. Boom, you know, it is always at a 90-degree angle and kind of squared off, and he's not going to move until he essentially gets what he came there for, or is asked to leave, basically. And I think composing these shots in a very formal way, which Bradford did, so each side of the equation had to be kind of weighted, so that, because obviously these are dialogue scenes, so I got to go back and forth. So to have those two sort of formal compositions, you know, opposing each other, put restraints on these guys as an actor, but then they have to kind of explode or hold in within that frame. And then hopefully when it goes into those action beats and sort of maintains that similar feel, although it's a totally different vibe of what's happening, it still feels like a real human, you know, event.
Even when when you're trying to comfort somebody, the way you move in on them is really intimidating. I mean, I just thought no wonder this poor kid ran off, because he wouldn't want to come back to you if he failed. I mean, it's weirdly a guy with almost no tenderness in him.
Well, I know JC was not a big fan of my exploration of his sociopathic tendencies, but I did actually read a lot about sociopaths in business, and the idea of someone who puts on empathetic traits, even though they don't actually feel them, as a means to an end. You know, ultimately, I do think, although he does try to do good by Julian, Julian's just a commodity.
But when he walks in the locker room, when he walks in and the camera's basically coming at him, you're about to hit him. I mean, it's almost a shot from a horror movie.
Right.
But you're supposed to be comforting this kid.
Yeah.
I just thought,
he's supposed to be getting him out on that truck is what he's doing. So that's that. It's worse than hitting him almost.
Sending him back out.
Which he clearly doesn't want to do. And
he's just basically, he's distraught. And this sort of outer countenance of comforting is even more discomforting, because there's no empathy in it.
Exactly. It seems like it's being empathetic. Go out there. Go
there's
back.
There's some empathy, but I would say maybe the pragmatic side overcomes that.
So I guess
defend my guy here.
But it's interesting, because that's a sort of scene where, in the more conventional drama, you know, there would be something to let us know that he wants him to be okay. But he really does want to go out there and do the job. I mean,
his first scene, we said this. I don't think I ever said it to you right before we shot, but we've certainly talked about it once the character kind of went beyond that point, you know, in our shoot and in the movie. The opening scene in the hospital is I don't want to put a percentage on it, but it is a lesser percent, but it's still there that he cares about this kid, right? So he's going to the hospital. He heard his wife was there. He better get over there to help this kid. But you know, the majority of that action he has thought through is that will go over well. He's going to go back to work and say that I went to the hospital to look after this kid, and that's going to be an effective leadership tool, right? Because, like, the word will get out that I help my guys when they go to the hospital. And so that's part of his, you know, leadership structure, basically, and what he does.
But that was a major challenge, you know, how to present someone that is that calculating in every aspect of their life. Sure. And yet still feel like you're getting to know what's inside of them. And I think the moments with his wife in particular, I think some of that stuff melts away. And you do see perhaps what's actually going on to a certain extent.
I think the scene...
Passion, you know, there's like for success and for your relationship.
Yeah, he's not detached. I mean, he's very attached to his goals and also, you know, incredibly emotional about what's happening. But I think the struggle is to mask that almost at all costs.
For me, the two great scenes in the movie are the scene where basically we realize she runs a business because she said, take those boxes out there. I don't even know what's in these boxes. She said, take them out there. I mean, it's both kind of funny and terrifying, and it tells us exactly where the balance of power is.
And what a good liar she was to, you know, him out in the driveway. It's like, I don't...
Yeah, it's that kind of compartmentalization, you know, where you know, he wants to play this character of the straight and narrow, but in order to do that, you have to be strategically ignorant about certain things, you know?
Well, that's funny, too, that you said, because part of this, you kind of wonder how much he believes and how much of this he knows isn't true. I mean, it's almost like that line, you know, purity of heart, the ability to will a single thing into being.
Yeah, I mean, he knows, I think they both as a couple, the way I sort of justified it is they both as a couple know that to be a great salesman, you're best when you actually believe what you're selling. You know, it's just a whole lot easier of a job. And so for him to be able to go out there with this sort of purity of believing his own kind of mystique, she probably realizes he's a better salesman. And so they literally, you know, but there is that moment in the early parts of the movie where he comes back from meeting the DA and she sort of gives him this BS line, you know, we follow industry standard practice, where he, you know, it's a very marriage and business moment where he should ask a follow-up question, obviously. She's put the responsibility on him to say, do you want to know this? And he, you know, physically, Oscar's body turns towards the door, and there's this sort of moment, and then he leaves, having not asked the follow-up question. So I think that's, for me, I do that in a lot of the different parts of my life, obviously, and you should confront something and talk to someone about something, and you know, it's there. And that can lead, if you let it get out of control, obviously, to grand, you know, grand things.
But the interesting thing is, too, because we can basically see when they're in the office, she's always on the calculator. She's actually doing the work, and he's sitting there like he's waiting to be photographed doing the work.
He's a little self-serious. I mean, give this guy a break.
But again, that posture, I mean, even when he's alone, he's waiting to be photographed for the company prospectus. And I wonder how much of that you worked out versus it coming to you as you sat down in the chair.
Yeah. I thought...
You actually, were just him at that point, man. He was...
Yeah.
He'd come in as this guy. You know, it's like, you know, walking around very, you know, it was...
It's strange what sticks, you know, you read a lot of stuff and then you see what you know, and when action happens, you know, I try to make it just an expressive thing without trying to communicate too many things. So, but I mean, going back and thinking about what may have influenced some of that as well, I read the Margaret Usener book, Memoirs of Hadrian, which really blew my mind, and I just thought it was such an interesting dissection of ambition and power. And
detachment.
Detachment, and also ethics, and how does someone that is that ambitious and wants that much power and yet has a sense of trying to be humane or trying to do it in the right way and trying not just to be a tyrant or a mediocrity. And so I did think of him a bit as that. As an emperor, as someone that was trying to transition from ambition to mastery, and that you know those moments when he, you know, and I think you said it. You said, you know, she's the one that's doing this, but you're just kind of sitting there thinking about the next sales pitch, or you know, it's more conceptual, right?
Yeah. Yes.
No, because what's interesting about the movie too for me is that last scene where he, because I found myself thinking the analog for me to this was Bugsy. Was a guy who saw the possibilities in the place that nobody else saw. I mean, but we have to remember too that not only was New York a violent place at that point, it was in a recession, and that he could see there were possibilities there. And I mean,
that's the optimism of them. I think the film obviously has this darkness over it, which is the compromise to accomplish your goal, which any goal that's sort of worthwhile has meaningful compromises that has to come with it. So you've got that singularity of vision, which is hard to watch, obviously. But the opening sort of action in the film is this great, I mean, Oscar said it earlier, this great sense of optimism, which is, you've got a building on fire. You know, New York City was on fire and people were abandoning it, much like we were talking outside a lot of the running scenes. You know, we had to go back to Detroit, actually, to find those miles of decay where you could just have those chase sequences. And so it was almost a tribute to that city that you know, you can rebuild things and change actually doesn't take as long as you sort of think it does when you look at the bigger picture. But, you know, to have that, yeah, I lost my chain.
No, but it's that you're talking about.
It's been a long day.
I'm sure, but these guys who see something that other people don't see. I mean, you've had these characters in all three of your films, these people who see, and you, the question is it vision or delusion?
It's both. I mean, it's human, you know, they're just human beings. So he is, I think, you know, the guy is making, you know, he believes in all of the choices that he's making, right? And so I think every act that he goes about is defensible. But is it warm and cuddly, you know? No, I mean it's
delusional until it works, I guess.
So you know, I find that interesting. It's you know, I'm trying to give you the same kind of thrill ride you would from, you know, an ordinary roller coaster. But when you kind of look back on it, you realize that you were going left when you thought you were going right.
Well, I just like the movie starts with motion, and by the end, he's become this emperor. I mean, he's sort of become the. It's almost like the journey of Michael Corleone. I mean, he's still at the end, and he's basically reading David and sort of saying, "Yeah, I understand. I can help you." He's become this prince of darkness that he imagined for himself at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he sees it as
yeah,
that
he
dark.
Doesn't see it that
I think
way at
that
all.
I think that, for instance,
I think he saw that moment on the bridge where the kid made that mistake. He says it to her wife. I mean, to his wife. You know, he says, "Why did he have to run?" Right. So that moment of weakness is where that true capitalism in him. You know, you put your fate in someone else's hands. It's not a good move, right? You are no longer in control of that, and so that's a sin to this guy, and not to Oscar. He makes a lot of mistakes, but
JC, he's right here.
I know.
Okay?
I've been doing so many of these without you here. I forgot. That's a sin. I mean, I'm all joking aside. At that moment, it's the saddest part of the movie for me is when he then says, "Sometimes you make mistakes you cannot, you know, recover from." And at that moment, if you look at that scene again, he turns on her in this rather brutal way, and he essentially starts talk about him moving in.
Exactly.
That is when he starts moving in on her, and is essentially saying, "Where the hell is he?" You know, and trying to intimidate her to sort of show, you know, in her actions. So later in the film, you know, when he shows up, there he's already written him off at that point, right? That, you know, he's made too many mistakes. And so that last scene, this is in Abel's mind, that last scene with David, the situation with Julian is not, that's nowhere even to be thought of, literally, at that point. And so his thoughts are very pure, which is, we've got a problem. I've gotten almost everything I need here. Let's work together, right? And so that's a very pragmatic response to being in business at that time. But, you know, it's hard to watch, obviously.
It is, because what I think the line is that defines him and could be a definition of almost any of your protagonists, the thing I fear most is failure. Right. And I wonder, I mean, that's a good...
Who wrote these movies anyway? I mean.
But talk about the way you came up about...
You probably got that from another movie anyway.
Talk about that. Your delivery of that line is so interesting because it's almost like this thing that you're not saying it as an aphorism. It's a belief for you.
Yeah, and also saying that you are a failure.
Yeah.
I think at that point he's very much done with this man, and also done with that part of himself. I think that that's something that was clear to me, that Julian was also him. That's who he was, and also what he was afraid he would become. So I think everything that he represents and all the stuff that he's been running from, just, you know, this kid takes on all of that. Again, the thing with Abel, though, is that I never thought of his choices as moral, as particularly guided by some sort of moral morality or righteousness. Even the guns, you know, the whole idea of not wanting guns around. And at first, I had a hard time understanding that. Even just with the family, you're like, oh, well, you're living in the Wild West, you're out in the middle of nowhere, you wouldn't even get a gun to protect yourself, even legally. And the more I explored that, I realized, oh, well, of course not, because it's just strategically a very stupid thing to do. It's exactly, you know, if he has a gun, even if it's legal, someone breaks in, he's going to use it, he's going to kill somebody. And that destroys the goal, which is, I'm not interested in being the owner of a few heating companies here in Queens and Brooklyn. I have my eyes set on Manhattan, on politics, on the, you know, on getting in bed with these people, of going all the way to the top. And if they can just dismiss me as some Latin thug with a gun, it's over.
Also, too, and I want to ask you about this too, JC. It also seems to be a way of saying, I am not your family, to his wife. I am not these thugs from Brooklyn. I don't carry a gun. I'm a businessman.
But it's pragmatic. I mean, it doesn't make sense, right?
No, I get that too. Like, but is it also this other thing as well, sort of making a statement about what he is not?
Just because it's stupid. Like, I think it's not his. The this guy is like that opening scene when he's looking at Manhattan. It's just that, right? So it's not deeper. You know, for Oscar, I think it was at one point Oscar was, early in the process, was asking me all these questions about heating oil, and I finally looked at him and I go, it's not about freaking heating oil. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's like not the point.
I was horrified.
The poor guy's trying to build this character, and he's like, the whole script's about heating oil. I'm like, only sort of, you know? But it, you know, the point is, it is a means to an end, right? So it is something that he realized was an opportunity that he could service a community. You know.
However, we did lay in his background, even though it's not in there. We thought, well, where did he come from? Because obviously he came from somewhere. And I looked around to, you know, we talked about what age he would have been, which was around 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah, 7 to 10, I think.
Yeah.
I told you.
And so I looked what was happening in Central America and South America at that time, which would have been in the, you know, mid to late 50s. And in Colombia, in Bogota, there was the civil war, which was called La Violencia, the violence.
And I said that one.
And that was happening at the time. I mean, well,
it was beautiful. I mean, it made perfect.
It was the horror that was happening. I mean, such atrocities. Yeah. And the idea that he came from that. So he has a very intimate knowledge of what violence is. And to come to this country to change all that, to leave all of that behind, that allowed it not to just be, sure, it's definitely a strategy, but there's a real rejection of everything that stands for as well.
Well, and what it did to, I mean, I think my idea for it, that was why he would have been sent away, right, with that violence. And then he would have come to the United States as this young kid, you know, potentially staying with an uncle or something or aunt, and seeing the late 60s kind of explode, and then watch that city that you would grow to love as your home kind of start to fall apart in front of your eyes to the same things that you were running away from or sent away from in the first place, you know, would cause someone to sort of shut down to a certain extent, but also just become so pragmatic and realize that it, I mean, it originally, the idea originated, I didn't really know it at the time, but you know, I was being offered a lot of, I needed a job. I was in the middle of editing a movie about one guy alone on a boat that you can imagine didn't pay very well. So I needed a job, and as I was editing All Is Lost and trying to write this film that I'd been thinking of for a long time, and a horrible violent act basically happened two towns over. There was a horrible school shooting at an elementary school, and I was driving my daughter into school after that, who was a first grader at the time, and there was an armed guard at the front door of our school, which I'm fairly pragmatic, and it's horrible to say this, but my first thought was essentially, there is literally like a, you know, I don't want to say it, but there's a hill, a knoll, so to speak, across from the parking lot. So you're essentially gave some poor sociopathic kid a target practice of this guy with a gun at the front door, and then you're right back where you were, right? So it's classic escalation issues. And but in the process, you've sent 400 kindergartners for several months by an armed guard to have to get into their elementary school. So what's the real damage sort of done there and through that escalation? You've essentially altered all of these young kids. Now, the school district sort of corrected themselves and came up with a very simple, yet still a bummer, but you have to go through two locked doors and the secretary stares you right in the eye, and then you get let into a school, which is a bummer, you know, because it's not that free, open thing that used to be there, but it's not a child having to go by an armed guard, and yet it's so much more effective. So the next thing I know, I'm looking at crime statistics, and that's basically when 1981 pops out. And so, you know, I realize that that's in this film, and you almost don't know that until you're done with it. But you know, so it's a pragmatic, you know, that scene with the little girl holding the gun obviously is like, it just doesn't make sense, right? It's like you only have to go like one or two moves ahead to see that that it doesn't make sense. And I think the one thing the character in the movie besides success that he wants is to not do things that don't make sense.
Sure. Well, this begs the question, the last question. You can't watch a movie and not be affected by the sounds of violence. I mean, the noise of that, just the back of that truck when that kid's been thrown in there, you hear his body hit that metal flatbed, or the sound, those gunshot sounds, or the sound of that car hitting that deer. I mean, that's like an explosion in the film. Talk about using that aural sound, that
aural. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously something I learned so much about on my last film, which is, you know, when you are in a heightened state of awareness in your life, you know, obviously all of your senses are heightened as well. And so hearing is one of them. And so to feel like you are those characters, essentially, you know, is hopefully what that sound is doing for you. But the interesting thing, the first thing you said, which is the sounds of violence, right? So there's this, to go back what I was just talking about, there's the core action, right? The people, there's the victim and the persecutor and all the people that are immediately around an act of violence, which is horrible. And their lives are irrevocably changed, obviously. But the sort of greater damage is essentially the waves that start to go out from that, right? So at this point in New York City's history, no one walked around. I mean, it's hard for people to imagine, but you know, my original research on this was these photographs from the day. And you just didn't walk around at night, right? I mean, go in the East Village in New York City right now, and there's people, you know, in bikinis walking around at 4 a.m, and it's a perfectly safe environment. So that is how quickly things can change one way or another, and it sort of happens without you realizing it, I think. And so those sounds are really, these guys, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, the movie's, you know, not actually that violent, you know, it's called A Most Violent Year, which when compared against other movies, that's very true. But when compared against a couple trying to run a small to medium-sized business, if you actually look at the sort of acts of violence in the film, that's almost an embarrassing thing to say, right? Because, like, there is horrible, horrible things that happen to them throughout the film if you actually bring them back to a human scale.
Yeah, because Oscar, the title doesn't just mean physical violence, but it's emotional violence, too. It's upheaval, and that's where the violence comes from, and that's in this story, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, it's their most violent year, and I think what's interesting is you know, the exploration of, is it possible, you know, in this country, which is so much about, you know, the hustle, and you know, you get rewarded for hustling, and that's what it's all about. You know, you got to find your way in, and how you can do that, and at what cost, And if it's possible to even do that ethically, you know, this is definitely somebody who believes in what I think is the myth of the self-made man. He severs his past. He doesn't want his employees speaking Spanish because he thinks that that's not the way to get ahead here. He very much buys into it, and in the end, succeeds. But there's definitely a cost, and it's that upheaval, and I think that's it's something that you've been exploring in your other films as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who has a job and has to make choices about time they're spending with family and on all the different things in your lives. I mean, it's not a straight path.
Exactly, and the idea that you do it in a vacuum and you're not doing it on the backs of others, whether it's your loved ones or your employees, or whatever, you know, it's definitely at a cost.
Well, let's thank these guys for being here.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
That was director J.C. Chandor and actor Oscar Isaac about their film A Most Violent Year. Thanks to Film Independent LACMA for letting us record. For more information and tickets, visit filmindependent.org/LACMA.